Judiciary Committee meeting to order uncharacteristically early by 1 minute. It's 1 minute to two. We have Senator Wilkowski, we have Senator McGuire, Senator Coghill, Senator Dyson, I know for sure, is up in the House Finance dealing with one of his bills, and they're actually going to be messing with one of my bills here in a few minutes. I think Senator Olson will be here shortly. The agenda today is we're going to take up House Bill 366, which is the involuntary commitment on firearms. We'll have the sponsor come up and talk. We've looked at it one time before, some committee discussion. Then I'm going to have House Bill 140 come up. We've been trying to get a first hearing on this. I think this is the third meeting we've tried to get this up, and it'll be the introduction, ombudsman introduction today, and that'll be House Bill 127 and House Bill 250, Representative Olson's medical malpractice. I'm going to try and get all of those up for their first hearing. Excellent. And my expectation is to bring them all up tomorrow and have committee discussion on them. So, but today I wanted to get them heard first, just get them started. So we have Majority Leader Representative Lance Pruitt. Why don't you come on forward real briefly? This is what is characteristically called the Nix Fix bill.
Yep.
And was there anything after you heard the discussion? Is there anything that you wanted to bring up, clarify, summarize on?
I don't think so. Actually, I think everyone kind of got our answers. I think we've tried to answer everyone else's questions as well.
I think so. We had we got a chance to talk to the FBI. We got a chance to talk to the federal people who were involved in this. And so I didn't see anything in here that I felt uncomfortable with. I think the courts were in agreement that they could do what was required of them here.
Right.
Is there any further discussion from the committee? Any questions for the representative, Senator Wilkowski?
No, I agree with everything you said, Mr. Chair. Just I haven't heard any opposition. Are you aware of any opposition to the bill?
The only person that we've heard in opposition was just the concern that we did hear last week from Ms. Wilson. I think I got her name right. We've responded to her on the concerns that she had and tried to clarify that. I think she might misunderstand a little bit of what we're doing here. So
I remember that now. Okay, thank you.
So with that, we have the R version, the CS for House Bill 366. The will of the committee is? Anybody?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the CS for House Bill number 366/R out of this committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Any objection to moving House Bill 366? With that, we will move the House Bill 366 to its next committee, which I think is the rules.
Should be rules.
And with that, we'll take a brief at ease while we sign these documents. Thank you. All right, we'll bring the Judiciary Committee back to order. The next up is the House Bill 140, which is relating to proposed adoption, amendment, or repeal of regulations relating to contact with agencies about regulations. Representative Reinbold is the sponsor. We have some people online to testify, but at this point, the purpose is to have you go ahead and explain and maybe talk us through the bill.
Thank you.
And introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Representative Reinbold, and I represent beautiful Eagle River. And thank you, Chair Coghill. I do appreciate having this opportunity, and Senate members of the Judiciary Committee, I appreciate you hearing House Bill 140. I know it's a very busy time, and I do consider it a privilege. The need for transparent regulatory system was evident as I went door-to-door in my community. Restaurants and other local businesses felt they were being overregulated and could not grow due to government requirements. The opportunity presented itself quickly when I became regulatory chair right away, And within 30 days of becoming chair, I dropped this bill, House Bill 140. So it's my first and only piece of legislation that's going to be worked, that I'm going to be able to work through the entire process during this session, hopefully. The need for reform of the regulatory process has been reiterated again and again as I worked through legislation on many, many other pieces of legislation. And with your permission, I'd like to read a quote from a letter.
Sure.
Okay, there was a letter that we received on another piece of legislation. I also serve on HESS. It says, the regulatory process is deficient and closed. The department, this is the Alaska State Medical Association that wrote this letter. The Department of Law advice to departments on the regulatory process dissuades public discussion or discourse once a regulatory package is released publicly. In fact, departments are often instructed not to answer questions or provide additional information during the public hearings, except for pointing to the exact language in the proposed regulation. This leads to a frustrating and seemingly meaningless public process beyond submitting written comment. Furthermore, once public hearings are held, there is no requirement that the final regulations be similar to the proposed regulation. This motivated me to continue my mission to reform, or help reform, the regulatory process. So the public process has been asking for increased transparency through the regulatory process, and House Bill 140 is a significant step in opening up the process and creating a more friendly business climate in Alaska. So there is 5 letters of support. We could have certainly got many more to that. I'm going to go ahead and go through the sectional in very generic terms.
Right, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. So House Bill 140, Section A, establishes the title, the Regulatory Impact Transparency Act. Section 2 creates necessary oversight of the regulatory system and allows the legislature to review regulations prior to them being filed to the lieutenant governor. It gives the governor 30 days to review a regulation to ensure that it's consistent with current law. It also enables the agencies to respond to an issue raised by the Administrative Regulatory Review Committee, with the exceptions currently of the ombudsman and victims' rights. Section 3 requires that the agency identify where the regulation is coming from. I became very confused because I would find statutes that weren't consistent with regulation, and I needed an identifier in there to figure out why these regulations were being promulgated. So this has them identify whether it's a federal, a court decision, or a state statute that promulgated the regulation. So at least we know where it's, the direction's coming from. It causes agencies to assess the costs in aggregate to the private persons, local governments, and other state agencies based on a good faith effort. This is very similar to Administrative Order 266, which we will be discussing in a few moments. Section 4, the Department of Law wording, protects the state from litigation, so one cannot sue based on insufficient or inaccurate information based on good faith estimates. So it's a protection for the state. It also increases clarity to the regulatory process, so agencies will be required to give a fair idea of the substance of the proposed regulation within the subject line in the emails when regulations go out, because we're going to get a lot. As you know, we get a lot of regulations, so at least, you know, if it's a topic of interest, it'll be right there in the subject line, so we can open that email and understand what it's about. Okay, Section 5 creates transparency, requiring agencies to document online public notice system, including information on regulations adopted by reference. A lot of regulations are adopted by reference, and it's important that people know where that's coming from. Section 6 requires boards and commissions and agencies to provide a brief description in clear and readable language. That could be one or two sentences just to tell us. I call it the by the way, so that they just need to tell us what happened. Section 7 improves the ability for the departments to address public inquiries. We had a big, big discussion about this in House Finance. The agents shall answer relevant questions if contacted. And Section 8 requires that oral and electronic comments be maintained as public record. Section 9 requires that in addition to sending notice of regulation to the Department of Law, agency shall also send it to the Administrative Regulatory Review Committee. And as Senator McGuire knows, we get a staffer, and it's extremely helpful for all these regulations that we deal with. Section 11 gives the administrative regulatory review 10 days after receiving regulations to submit comment to the lieutenant governor. And it's based on two different issues, just to make sure that it's consistent with law or to address, you know, a concern in particular that's raised by the regulatory review committee. And Section 12 is just simply applicability language. There was,
Continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was an indeterminate fiscal note, and I would like the opportunity to discuss that.
All right.
Okay, there are a few agencies, the RCA, the Board of Game and Board of Fish, that do get an inordinate amount of regulations. Many more regulations are going to be promulgated by them than others. So we are working with them, talking with them, and seeing if they need to potentially be exempted from provisions based on input from you and your committee, okay?
Yeah, and I think that's the those committees, RCA, and probably AOGCC are the ones that I've heard probably are the ones that we need to think about very seriously.
Correct, correct. And so we're happy to work with your committee members and your direction in regards to this. We are working with all of them at this time.
Good.
Just getting input and so we will definitely be.
That would fall under the Section 6, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, there's some of the provisions, and I'll be happy to come back to the committee and talk in particular about which specific provisions in this
plan on dealing with tomorrow in substance.
Absolutely.
There are probably outside of that. Are there other questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the bill. I think it's the heart of it's in the right place. I think there's some tweaks that need to be made to it. I appreciate you coming by my office and sitting down with me and going through it. That was very helpful. Same concerns, though, as you have, Mr. Chair, and I see the letter we have here from AOGCC expressing a number of concerns. I don't know which agency. One of the concerns that they point out is just that giving the governor veto power over decisions of an agency that was designed to be independent could violate that independence, and I don't know what other. I guess we'd have to sit down and figure out all the agencies that are out there. Workers' Comp, for instance, I know they have sort of an independent organization. That may be one we want to exclude. I sort of wonder if it's not better to just strip out Section 2 as a whole, Mr. Chair. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I got legal through the chair. Mr. Chairman, can I speak?
Sure.
Okay. Basically, I got our legal department to basically ask if it's quasi-judicial, does it need to be removed? There's nothing in this bill that requires just because they're quasi-judicial, just because they were designed to be independent. Again, our legal department.
Representative, is that in writing? Is that something you can get to the committee?
Yes,
it is. All right.
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind getting that to the committee, I think in talking to the Department of Law, the veto power was one of the questions that I had as well. What was your understanding of the governor's veto power?
There's absolutely nothing in this bill that gives veto power, period. And that's what's so concerning, Mr. Chairman, through this. There's nothing that does. There's only simply in Section 2 that says that the governor may send a regulation back to an agency, one, if it's inconsistent with law, or two, to address. He may send it back. But there's zero veto power.
Senator Wilkowski.
And I guess we can debate what the term veto means. But if a governor says, if a governor doesn't like the bill, he's going to figure out a reason why it's wrong, and he's going to send it back. And I don't know that we want to give that level of power to a governor, particularly when we have these independent agencies set up, Fish and Game, for instance, Board of Game, Board of Fish, AOGCC, Workers' Comp. We have an extremely strong governor in this state, probably one of the strongest in the country. I don't know that we want to be placing independent agencies, giving him what really is tantamount to veto power. I just don't know that that's something that I feel real comfortable going to, Mr. Chair.
And we can have further discussion on this. I do have one other question under Section 11, and since you're the chair, and we have Senator McGuire, who's chaired before, the 10 days reviewing. Is that, do you think, after having run the committee a little bit, and maybe Senator McGuire could chime in, is 10 days enough, knowing how fast maybe sometimes regulations can come flowing in? So, Representative?
If you have an active committee and you have a good staffer, 10 days is certainly adequate. And also, the governor in section only has 30 days in total. We didn't want to slow down the regulatory process unnecessarily. But there's no elected official. What we've learned, Mr. Chairman, is that a board or a commission can write a regulation, and people think it's the legislators writing these regulations, and sometimes they're in conflict, and there's no elected official at all of any check and balance at this time. And sometimes we have to answer to the people, and that's why we wanted a very tiny check of an elected official, and we made sure we put may and not shall, and absolutely no veto power.
So, yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair, I would just say on that point, I agree with Representative Reinbold, and right here in the 10 days, you're striking a balance because on the one hand, you're inserting yourself into the process, which is good, but on the other hand, you don't want to be accused of delaying the process because it may be a reg that the public agrees with, and it may be one that has no problem and has a public good. So I think it strikes the appropriate balance. I like that it says may, and I hope that its presence, though, will, you know, raise that flag for all of us, and that says that it ought to be a subject of review, and so that we start getting into that habit, and that the administration starts looking for that. Hey, by the way, is there anything that came out of the Admin Reg Review Committee? I was having a conversation this morning. John was a part of it, and I said that when I was a freshman, I chaired the committee, and I didn't get the memo that we weren't supposed to really meet and that we were supposed to just rubber stamp regulations as well, and everybody laughed, and it's true. So I was a lot like you. I just went raring into it because I had spent so much, and Jim Pound, who's here, was my committee aide, so much time in my campaign trail with my neighbors saying this was one of their number one concerns, that especially as small business people, that these regs would come out frequently when we're out of session, and then they'd be noticed, and they couldn't find the notices, and then how to be a part of the process. So I learned, like you, that yes, they're required, there's a review, quote-unquote, by the lieutenant governor, but it's really rubber stamping, cursory. So not a single person, as you said, that actually has a connection to the public is in that process, and because we know that reg writers are not subject to election. And so I think it's a great bill, and I think it's a great provision that's in there, but we're all going to have to be disciplined in recognizing it will increase our workload. But then you're going to want good chairmen and women on both sides to be here and really paying attention to it. And the other point I want to just make is really serious things that we dealt with. Like, for an example, I'll just give you one. The legislature passed the Aquatic Farm Act in 1984, and we said we want shellfish farming. We think this is an opportunity to diversify economies in Southeast where timber had gone away as an industry. But we said no finfish farming. And what we had was a Fish and Game Department completely devoid of the governor or anyone else that was on their own mission to regulate out that policy, basically. Through the regulations, they made it impossible to get these permits. And it was only through the work of our committee that we were able to implement the actual intent of the 1984 Aquatic Farm Act. And so they're very serious things that people are dealing with. Mm-hmm.
I do have several people here, so for the committee, I do have Jim Cantor, who's Deputy Attorney General, who's online for questions, so I think the veto power may be one of those questions. I have Norm Roeperg with the RCA, I have Stuart Goring, RCA, I have Arnold Liebelt, who's here for questions from OMB. Fish and Game, Kevin Brooks is here. I think actually in the committee I saw him. He's available for questions. But I do have some people signed up for public testimony. But is there any questions at this point for those, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, just going back to the AOGCC concerns, Concern number one is the bill would force the commissioners to participate in ex parte communications. We don't have a lot of, I think this is the only one I have from an agency, but I'm concerned that we're going to pass, that we may be applying things and other agencies aren't speaking up. And do you have any thoughts on that concern that AOGC has expressed?
Representative Reinbold.
Senator Bilikowski, through the chair. There's nothing that requires a commissioner to participate in ex parte communications. They can work through their staff, but there's nothing that the commissioner has to directly be involved.
Senator
Bilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just read you what they're saying. Anyone who wanted to could call up and require a commissioner to explain our reasons for a proposed regulation or regulatory change. We don't currently have conversations like this with individuals because as a quasi-judicial body, we make all of our decisions as part of the public process. So with lawmakers, you can come in and we can have discussions and we can do it publicly, we can do it privately. We can't make decisions unless we're public. But I think what these commissioners are saying is, hey, when we make our decisions, we're out in the public. What this would do is allow people to just call up and say, hey, I want a reason for what you're doing. And then the commissioners would be required to engage in that back and forth, which is you can't do that with judges. And so that's where you get into that ex parte issue.
Okay. Representative?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bilikowski, they can provide frequent asked questions on a website to deal with that as well. So that is one way. They also could do a public hearing and answer questions at that time. So it doesn't mean that on every question, that they have to go directly. It's just we want to make sure that the people, have an opportunity to speak with their government.
No, and if I could, Mr. Chair, I agree. I think there's parts of this bill that I think are great. I'm worried about in particular, I guess, the quasi-judicial bodies, the decision-makers there that are acting like judges. With judges, you can't call up a judge and say, hey, I want to have a conversation with you about my case. And you can't do that. That's ex parte. And I guess so maybe if we can include a provision there that says it doesn't apply to quasi-judicial decisions, that would make me feel more comfortable and probably some other organizations that are out there.
Okay.
So, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, if I could address Senator Bilikowski.
Senator
Bilikowski, this is very important, we're listening. There is one. We got legal advice, and our legal department said just because they're independent or quasi-judicial doesn't exclude them from provisions in this bill. However, we also did find a statute that stated that the way that the AOGCC does write their regulations, that it may be of concern, and so therefore we were willing to address this through the. We're working with the chairman now.
The plan is to bring a CS that will try to help us navigate through some of those and still allow us to have some review. That's what we're working on. Mm-hmm. And I know some of the agencies are concerned. Any questions for the Attorney General's office at this point? I was going to go ahead or do you want to do public testimony first and then go to some of those questions? Why don't we do that so that we don't have people hanging online? I think I have Sarah Geary. Are you here in the room with us, Sarah? She's with the Alaska Municipal League, and then Leslie Orbaugh after with Assisted Living Association of Alaska. Nice to see that name. And so at this point, Sarah, put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Sarah Geary. I'm legislative coordinator for the Alaska Municipal League. Alaska Municipal League would like to offer their support for HB 140. As many regulations at the state level and few at the federal level impact municipalities' budgets, it would be extremely helpful to have an idea of those impacts, of what those impacts will be for planning purposes. This bill will ensure that agencies take into consideration the costs that these regulations will introduce and create awareness of potential costs that will be imposed upon individuals, businesses, and municipalities. Having this information can also be helpful to legislators to identify upcoming legislation that will have a costly effect. Thank you for your attempt to encourage all involved to look at broader impacts of regulation changes, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Any questions for Sarah? greatly appreciate you coming to the committee and making your comments. Leslie Orbaugh, you're online. Put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, this is Leslie Orbaugh from the Assisted Living Association of Alaska. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I would like to offer my support to House Bill 140, the Regulation Transparency Act. The unintended consequences and costs to organizations and individuals surrounding legislation and specifically to regulations has long plagued the business industry in our state. And I can say this because I've been in business in our great state for 24 years. Although the government officials have many times said that they have considered private businesses, it has appeared to those of us who are in private business that there has been no consideration. We have had public testimony, they listen, and they go away and do as they wish. We would like to support this regulation in its entirety. I think it is probably one of the best moves that our legislation could make. And I thank each and every one of you for being there today, for hearing me, for allowing this to happen, and hope that you do pass this bill. Thank you.
Leslie, thank you very much for taking the time and listening in on the conversation as we led up to this. And it's good to hear you, and we'll look forward to working with you. And I'm hoping that this will come out in good order. So thank you very much for taking your time.
And thank you, sir.
We have National Federation of Independent Businesses. Is it Al Tamangi?
Yes, this is Al Tamangi from Mankato. I'm a member and the leadership chair of the NFIB Alaska. I think my comments would echo those of the previous speaker that has already been, I think, very adequately, elaborate. I think that this gives us, the business people, an opportunity to voice our opinions and also put some responsibility on the agencies. It's really nice in a bureaucratic position to go through the drill, but when you're on the other end of that drill, I think this bill certainly offers an opportunity to equalize, the playing field. It's good full and open disclosure, and I think this bill should be supported and moved out of committee. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer those.
Thank you, Al. Is there any questions? For those online, what we're going to do is we're going to lay this bill aside, but tomorrow we will bring it up, and we will have a CS that will help us answer some of the questions that are brought up today. I don't know that we're going to actually have this room, so it will be announced where we're meeting. I know we, if they're in this time of the year, trying to find a room. Is any last questions for the sponsor before we let the representative go? All right. Is there any last comments that you wanted to make, or is there any testimony? All right. What we're going to do is we're going to lay 140 aside so that we can get to the others, get them introduced. And tomorrow, it'd be my expectation, we'll bring it up and deal with it. Try to bring it up for a vote. All right? Thank you very much for coming to committee, and thank you for all that were involved in coming to committee, listening to the testimony. You heard some of the questions. We need to get them answered by tomorrow, and I think we will. So thank you very much. With that, we're going to take up the Ombudsman Bill, which is House Bill 127 at this point. And this is our first look at it. Once again, there was it came to us, but it's actually been sitting in our committee for a while because we wanted to wait for the House to finish their work out. And at this point, I think we're good. And so before us, we have Linda Lord-Jenkins, who is the ombudsman, and who has done a wonderful job down through the years. We have Beth, and I got Leibowitz. I got it pretty close, didn't I? thank you for coming before the committee, and just put yourself on the record, whoever is going to start the testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Coghill. My name is Linda Lord Jenkins, and I am the State of Alaska Ombudsman. I appreciate you taking the time to hear our bill. The Ombudsman Act has not really changed much since the Act was enacted in 1975. I believe the last time that we were to up to the Capitol for any sort of amendments was in 1980, and I'm sorry, 1990. Wow. And yeah, it's been a long time. We proposed a bill that had a lot of changes when it came from House Judiciary. I've likened this to what is it, the Rolling Stones song? You don't always get what you want, mm-hmm. but you get what you need.
This is the Ombudsman Light.
Yes. The bill, as it has been amended, has several sections. It has eight sections. Section 1 would provide that the Ombudsman can receive a step increase in salary rather than remaining at Step A of Range 26 for the Ombudsman's entire term. The Ombudsman right now is, as I understand it, is the only position in the legislative branch that is frozen in pay. Mm-hmm. And what this means is if you spend a lot of time here, you may get a cost of living increase, but that's the extent of the increase. LAA Personnel Director Skiff Lobaugh is here if you have any questions about that aspect.
All right.
Section 2 is clarifies the Ombudsman ability to hire additional staff using a personal service contract pursuant to 2455060. We have over the years on occasion hired generally retired Ombudsman staff who may have been Tier 1, but we don't hire, we do this under a contract. And Ms. Leibowitz can, if you have any questions about that, Ms. Leibowitz can explain the ins and outs of the legalities, but this basically cleans up that activity so that we've been able to do it, but it's a fairly convoluted process, and we wanted to bring our statute in line with what's going on in the state. Section 3 amends the Ombudsman's investigatory authority to refer to an agency instead of a state agency. This may seem like a very small point, but the Ombudsman has the statutory authority to contract with municipalities and with school boards, but if we retain the language of state agency, that means that we don't have access to those boards and municipalities' records. So this just cleans that up if we contract. We used to contract with a lot of municipalities. We don't have any under contract right now, but that doesn't mean we don't have the authority to do that at some point. Section 4 has to do with attorney-client privilege waivers. Right now, the Ombudsman does not have the authority to require an agency to waive attorney-client privilege information. The agency can do that if they choose to. However, and again, I'm not the attorney. Beth can explain this if you have questions. My understanding is that if an agency waives privilege, an attorney-client privilege, as to the Ombudsman, it can be interpreted to waive that privilege to all other parties. What we seek to do here is to allow agencies, if they to waive that privilege, as to us, but that way it does not require that they waive it to other individuals.
Got it.
Section 5 improves the wording of the Ombudsman privilege not to testify or produce records regarding matters brought to the Ombudsman attention in the course of the Ombudsman's duties. What this does is strengthen that particular statute. We have the confidentiality of Ombudsman records has long been a core belief of the Ombudsman institution here and across the country and the world, and we want to make sure that that's as strong as it can be. Section 6 has to do with the Ombudsman procurement authority. It brings our procurement statutes up to those statute, the revised procurement laws that were passed last year or last session. And Section 7 and 8 have to do with amending court rule amendments because they deal with the attorney-client privilege information and privilege not to testify.
Pretty straightforward. Any questions at this point? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a constituent who you and I spoke mm-hmm. about many times, and she had put in a request. She had just an awful incident that occurred to her. I don't want to rehash it. Got arrested. It was a false arrest. Filed a complaint, and it languished for, God, it was over a year, maybe 2 years. And she was, I spoke with her many, many times, spoke with you. And the question that she had was on timelines, mm-hmm. and that became a concern for me as well. Are there timelines for the release of ombudsman reports for how long you can take to complete an investigation?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, there are timelines, but they're quite frankly impractical given the amount of work that we have. The case that you are talking about was a fairly complex, detailed, second-by-second breakdown of what happened in about 5 minutes. And then how the agency responded to this complainant's case. The timelines then were affected by the fact that there's only one executive and one admin in my office, and I'm the executive, and then we have one, our intake secretary handles part of, you know, about 25% of her responsibilities are admin, and my office, I become the bottleneck just because of lack of deputies who can vet a lot of this information. So there are timelines. They're just simply not practical to carry out given our workload and the number of people that we have working.
Do you know how many complaints or investigations are requested each year?
Well, we have every case that we get in the door is a potential investigation, and in some respects they are all investigations. It just depends on the amount of work. We always have to make an inquiry or find out all that we can before we decide how we're going to handle a particular case. Last year I believe that we had 1,200 cases that complaints that came in the door. And this year, I checked before I came over, we're up 34% over the prior year in complaints that have come in the door.
And Senator?
Is there a way that we can fix that through some legislation? Because I know 1,200 cases for two people is a lot, and if it's just increasing. And I can just tell you, I've had, you know, this isn't the only constituent that's come to me with this concern. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the person that they go to mm-hmm. express concerns about government, and if they're not getting that relief, you know, for a year, over a year, and it was extremely traumatic in, you know, that one woman constituent, and other constituents have shared that concern. I mean, is there something else that you think we can do to try to speed that process up or ensure that we are following the timelines?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I hate to say money, but staffing. Mm-hmm. Staffing. It has been my practice not to request more money and more staffing unless I see a sizable jump in caseload. And this year I'm seeing a very sizable jump in caseload, so I anticipate that next year I will be asking for more staff. But that's generally the way to resolve these things. We have taken several steps to increase the processing of cases that don't go to full formal investigation, and one of those things is we've beefed up our intake staff dramatically. We used to have one person who handled all of our intake. We now have three, which means that the overall employees, investigators in the office are handling more complex issues, while the simpler matters can be handled by intake staff. That's meant that I'd say 95% of the cases that come in are in and out the door within a month. Frequently, they're in and out the door within a week. But that's about as much blood as we can get out of that turnip right now.
And the way I understand it, Linda, is that at this point, you are under this law getting a little more flexibility under some contracting, but without the cash, that's a very limiting factor.
Correct.
That is correct. I would like to send this authority up to the Finance Committee, and I think this does have a Finance Committee referral, and so what I was hoping to do is move it up to them. It does not have a Finance Committee referral? Oh, I'm sorry.
We don't. There should be no finance referral. There had been when we, before the bill was amended in the House.
Oh, I see. Okay. My apologies, because I was looking at version B here that says referred finance. I'm sorry. So my staff probably is going back there.
No.
All right. Good. Well, that helps. But you do get the authority for contracting, which is, gives you some flexibility, the way I understand it.
Mr. Chairman, yes. What we have done with that contracting authority is an example. In 2008, we hired two individuals who had been who were Tier 1 retirees, one of whom had worked in the office back in the 90s, and another who had broad general government experience. Because they were Tier 1, we did not pay into the PERS system for them, and we did not pay health insurance for them, and we were able to get two for the price of one.
I see.
So that's generally what that contracting ability means for us.
And so the procurement is pretty straightforward. The court rules have to do with the confidentiality, which I think is tightened up. So. Or the privilege, basically.
Yes.
Right. Any other questions? Do I have any? I don't have any other testimony. Beth, did you have anything you wanted to add?
To the chair, no, not at this time.
All right. Question? Any further questions from the committee? Senator Wilkowski?
We're on version B, just so we're all clear.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And because I don't have a previous version, it looks like there's been
changes. I was just looking at it, said referred finance, but that had been removed, the way I understand it. So.
And there's a lot of reference to the Alaska Bar Association, but it, as I'm reading this,
that was the original version. That's why this is called Ombudsman Light. There were several things that were taken out, including looking at the Alaska Bar Association as an agency.
Oh, I remember now.
Yes.
Got it.
And that's actually
been, we haven't seen this bill in a while.
Yeah, and it's been sitting in our committee waiting for the House to figure it out.
Got
so.
It. Okay.
And for me, we ask a lot of our ombudsman, and it's been an agency greatly in need and greatly in tension for many years, and so it's just something that the legislature has been reluctant to kind of let the reins loose on. Senator?
Thank you. I just want to say on the record, thank you to Linda Lord Jenkins. I was there as the chair over in the other body when she was first confirmed, and we were looking at a variety of candidates, and she was the best one that came through for sure, and I just thank her for all of her. You know, she's very responsive to the legislature and to the people of the state, and I appreciate that because it's frustrating when you're a member of the public and you have a concern and you don't know where to go. And you've been very patient and responsive to people, and you know, be sure to keep us in the loop on resources. It is hard to ask for resources at a time when there's deficit spending, but this is one of those lifelines to the public that's very important that we preserve, so thank you.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. Just on Section 4, if we are the only committee of referral, I probably want to get a little bit more detail on how Section 4 and Section 5, where this is coming from, what the problem is. Has this arisen under specific cases?
This is the attorney work privilege.
Yeah, attorney work privilege, for instance, Section 4. Maybe we can start with
maybe
that.
Maybe we could have Beth speak to that. Beth.
Interesting. To the chair and the committee, I'm Beth Leibowitz. I'm an assistant ombudsman based in Juneau. And Section 4 is addressing the fact that we have mandatory access to most state agency records. That specifically excludes attorney-client privileged communications and attorney work product. However, we've had instances over the years where executive branch agencies have given us communications from their assistant AG, usually in response to a question of why did you do that? And they'll say, well, the Department of Law told us that's what we should do, or that it was okay. And they'll say, really? And sometimes they have offered us that material, sometimes not. When looking at the issue a little more closely, I realized that there's case law, not so much in Alaska, but in the lower 48 and in federal cases, indicating that that could inadvertently create a general waiver of privilege for those agencies. And that's not a consequence that we want to have happen. So we would like to continue their ability to cooperate with us during an investigation without it having unfortunate consequences for them in some unrelated litigation. And we also are not able to disclose that material once we get it. Not only is it confidential under our statute, but we have that testimonial privilege that we're beefing up is designed specifically to make sure that stuff doesn't come out of our office if we have access to it.
Senator Wilkowski.
I think the thing that triggered, that perked my ears, was the last part of this, which what if you find something illegal? What if you find that the agency's breaking the law or doing something wrong, and there's conversation, privileged conversations about that? Isn't that something that you would want to disclose to the public, or you would want people to know about?
Beth?
To the chair and to Senator Wilkowski, that is the essence of the Ombudsman Act, is that we can report back to the agency, and we can tell them that we think they're breaking the law, and we can report to the legislature and the public that we believe that the agency is acting contrary to law. But no, we cannot disclose confidential information or that we got. We can offer a conclusion to the public, but one the caveat to the type of access that we have is that we can't publicize material that would otherwise not be public.
Very similar, if I understand correctly, Senator, to they do a lot of investigation into both health issues in jail and OCS issues. A lot of confidentiality information there, but they can still tell us if medical information is not happening correctly, or if people are not getting served well, or if children are not getting served well. So,
I agree, except here you may be privy to information like clear emails between an attorney and an agency director or something that says, hey, I broke the law, what do I need to do? Or something of that nature, and the public will never know about it. Could the legislature disclose that if you disclose it to the legislature?
Beth?
To the chair and to Senator Wilkowski, my understanding of what this statute would do is that if we get it and we're basically let into that bubble of privilege, no, we cannot disclose it. We can report our conclusions to the public and the legislature, but the catch on the type of access we have is that we have to respect the confidence, and especially with attorney-client privileged material, if the agency actually antes up and gives it to us, we're going to have to respect that privilege. And yes, there's a potential problem there, but they also have the option of, I would suspect if it's a case of assistant AG telling an agency director or commissioner that they're breaking the law, I think the chances that we will have that info, that communication shared with us, might be very, very low, unless it's by mistake.
Linda?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we have had cases where agencies have inadvertently provided us attorney-client privilege information in complaints, and we have found that the agency has not followed the AG's advice. We have notified both the agency commissioner, the department commissioner, and the AG of that. That generally takes care of the problem. We in those cases would tell the complainant that they're, for reasons that we cannot divulge to them, we have found that particular allegation to be justified. But we tell them under 2455-160 that we cannot reveal confidential information.
That's one of the reasons why it's important when you read the Ombudsman report that you watch very closely what they're saying.
And then, Mr. Chair, in Section 5, then we're creating a further provision that if they can't be subpoenaed or deposed or testify on what they find out. So the Ombudsman could go in, could uncover some highly illegal activity. They can't disclose it. They can't testify on it. They can't be subpoenaed on it. I see where they're coming from with this. I just worry about the potential ramifications, and I'm trying to figure out a way to fix it.
Beth, you want to answer that?
To the chair and Senator Welikowski, regarding the testimonial privilege, that section is basically clarifying a section that has existed in the Ombudsman Act since 1975. The current language says that we may not testify in a court proceeding except as necessary to carry out our duties under this chapter. And in looking at that, I've spent a number of years periodically writing letters to private attorneys who would like our files as free discovery. And so I want it to be very clear that not only do we not appear in court, testify in litigation, unless necessary to enforce our duties under the Act. You know, it does provide us with a limited ability to testify or produce documents to carry out our job. This privilege is designed to keep us from being an inadvertent discovery source for other litigants, because that's not what we're about. And the amendments in this bill are designed to make it absolutely clear that not only do we not appear to testify, but we don't produce our files, and we don't produce them in either judicial proceedings or in administrative hearings, such as the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is currently not referred to in our statute. So we are not changing the basic nature of the privilege that has existed since 1975, but we are trying to make sure that it really does cover what I believe it was intended to cover.
Senator?
I'll just, for the record, the current 2455-260 is very short. It says the ombudsman and the staff of the ombudsman may not testify in a court regarding matters coming to their attention in the exercise or purported exercise of their official duties, except as may be necessary to enforce the provisions of this chapter. And we're extending that to can't be deposed, can't release records, can't release drafts, notes, intake, review, investigation. So it's a pretty big broadening. And then you're not subject to disclosure or production in response to a subpoena. So I would say it's a pretty big, we're really tightening up the ombudsman's privilege here. And again, Mr. Chair, it's a policy call. The ombudsman is there. We send them out to investigate when constituents have issues or complaints or concerns. And here we're just tightening up what they can release. I just don't know if that's the best policy call to say, go out and investigate it, but then we're not going to let you release the notes, the investigation, the intake, the review, the complaints. We're going to give you attorney-client privilege over information that you find. Why are we doing this investigation, I guess? Why do we have the ombudsman if it's not to release public information, not to release the information that we found?
Linda Lord-Jenkins, you have a response?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, thank you. I explained very recently to an attorney who wanted to review depositions that we had taken that the ombudsman does not exist to provide free discovery to litigants. Our purpose for existence is to help government do what it's supposed to be doing and resolve complaints against state government, but and the ombudsman has never been envisioned as an entity that is an adjunct to private litigants against the state. That's why the information that we obtain is information that others can obtain through other sources, but the goal is not to have us provide free discovery for any entity. We would find, I think, that our job would be a lot more difficult if that was where things were going.
It's point well taken.
I don't know what the right answer is, Mr. Chair. It's a tough one.
I wanted us to take as much time as we had with these two in front of us, because this is the day that I wanted to deal with it. I can hold it over till tomorrow, let you ponder it if you wish. Since it was the first hearing, that's probably reasonable to do. By the way, we're going to be in the Fehrenkamp room at 1:30 tomorrow, so just to give you a heads up. Let's do that. We'll lay it aside. Those are some of the salient questions, I'm amiable to them. I wanted to take the last few minutes to let the next bill come up, so thank you, Linda Lord-Jenkins. Thank you. Ms. Leibowitz. And so we'll bring it up tomorrow for further discussion. At this point, I have House Bill 250. I wanted to have a representative of Mr. Olson, Representative Olson's office to come. This is I think, commonly called the I'm Sorry Bill. That is, that gives the doctors, it sounds to me like the privilege to say condolences to people who have suffered great loss. So, and before our committee, presenting this is?
Chairman Cargo, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erica O'Sullivan, staff to Representative Olson. Before you today is House Bill 250, version P.A., an act making an expression of apology, sympathy, commiseration, compassion, or benevolence by a healthcare provider inadmissible in a medical malpractice case, requiring a healthcare provider to advise a patient or the patient's legal representative to seek legal advice before making an agreement with the patient to correct an unanticipated outcome of medical treatment or care, and amending rules 402, 407, 408, 409, and 801 Alaska Rules of Evidence. And before I get into the bill presentation, I would like to acknowledge that Mr. Doug Wojcicki, the author of Sorry Works, Mike Hagan, Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association, and Ms. Megan Wallace of Ledge Legal are online to testify or answer questions if we are able to get to that.
We do have Mike Hagan on, and I think what we'll do is, as soon as you can, I will give him a couple of minutes to testify. Give us as brief a description as you can. We're going to bring it up tomorrow again, by the way.
Okay.
And so let me just ask Mike. Mike, can you hear us?
Hello.
Mike, we're only going to have about four more minutes to present the bill, but I was going to bring it up tomorrow from 1:30. This and the ombudsman bill will be up tomorrow. Can you be with us tomorrow?
I could, or I can give you my 30-second testimony if you've got that.
Why don't we just take your 30-second testimony now, and then I'll let the bill sponsor round out the rest of the discussion tomorrow.
All right. Thank you for letting me testify. My name is Mike Hogan. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association, representing approximately 600 physicians around the state. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 250. Physicians feel that open communication between physicians and patients is vital to ensure the best possible healthcare outcomes. Fear of being sued can hinder such open communication, and HB 250 seeks to address those concerns by shielding providers from expressions of sorrow, sympathy, or apology, making them inadmissible in a medical malpractice case. We think that it's appropriate to draw a line between admission of legal liability or negligence and the expressions of apology or sympathy. And I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Very well said, Mike. Greatly appreciate it. I'm going to give the sponsor of the bill the last 2 minutes. Seems how I've lost a quorum, there's not much else we can do anyway, so you get the last 2 minutes of the committee, sorry to tell you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If that's all right, I'll just address the intent of the bill, and then I can do the explanation of changes at the next hearing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. House Bill 250, also known as the I'm Sorry Bill, would render expressions of apology...
Keep going.
Would render expressions of apology or sympathy by a healthcare provider to a patient related to an unanticipated outcome of treatment inadmissible as evidence in a malpractice case. This is similar to legislation that has passed in over 30 states. And as you saw in your packets, there's a state-by-state breakdown in a publication produced by the American Medical Association. As addressed in the sponsor statement, the bill is intended to clear up the gray area which now exists between apologies and admissions of neglect, and to improve doctor-patient relationships, especially in cases ending in a less than favorable outcome. Unfortunately, healthcare providers often cut off communication after adverse events, which can lead to anger and the perception that there is a lack of caring or that a mistake was made, even if in reality no error has occurred. It is not negligence, but rather a failure in communication between the provider and patient that often results in malpractice lawsuits. Now, this bill will by no means prohibit malpractice lawsuits, but to quote bioethicist Art Kaplan, whose full interview transcript you saw in your bill packets, you can talk about your feelings without having that held against you or being the trigger to a lawsuit. This legislation will enable healthcare providers to better fulfill their moral and ethical responsibilities to the patients and their families through expressions of compassion and sympathy without fear of retribution in the form of a lawsuit. And that's where I'll leave it for today.
And I see where liability and responsibility words were taken out. So I think those are some of the things we'll talk about tomorrow. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah. If I'm just trying, maybe some hypotheticals might help me a little bit. Go to see a doctor, you get your surgery done, you have pain in your stomach, you come back, doctor finds out he left a sponge in, not uncommon. Doctor says, I'm sorry I left a sponge in your stomach. Would that be admissible?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, not necessarily. If you look in the version in front of you in subsection B on page 2, line, let me see here, let's see, line 18. That subsection was added with the intent of adding additional scrutiny to a statement of apology or sympathy that was made in conjunction with an admission of negligence or liability. So, and that separated that the apology part was inadmissible, but not necessarily the admission of negligence.
Okay. So the I'm sorry part would be inadmissible, but the I left the sponge in your stomach would be admissible.
Would be potentially admissible. Potentially that is admissible. Correct.
Okay, and would, if the doctor then, okay, so you're having a conversation with your doctor, I've got this pain in my stomach, there's a sponge left in here, doctor says, hey, I'm sorry, that's not admissible.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the intent is that an apology is not admissible.
And what we're going to do, Senator, now that you've got your thinker going on this, we'll bring this up tomorrow, and I think we'll have all of these questions on record, and I want the rest of the committee to hear some of those because those are going to be very important factors as we move forward on this. And so we're going to hold over House Bill 250 until tomorrow. We're going to meet in the Farron Camp Room from 1:30 to 3, and we'll try to be as prompt as we can. We have two bills on that we'll be dealing with. We'll deal with the Ombudsman bill, and we'll deal with this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. With that, we're going to adjourn this meeting.